Deutsche Welle, Living Planet.
This week on Living Planet, leopard attacks increase as India's urban areas grow.
The boy had been crouching in the dark at an outdoor toilet. The leopard attacked him from behind and took him away.
Vietnamese fishermen in Louisiana leave the wild waters and turn to aquaculture.
Almost every aspect of the growing process can be controlled, ensuring that the farmers, like Sang, enjoy greater financial stability.
And Sarajevo reclaims its green spaces more than two decades after the city was destroyed by war.
Luca and his friends arrive at one park near the city centre with big brooms, rakes and rubber gloves on.
I'm Saroja Coelho. Welcome to the show. We're starting this week's show in the company of a mighty wildcat, the leopard. I was asked this weekend by some friends what the difference is between a cheetah and a leopard, and I have to confess I wasn't able to answer, but I've done my homework since then. Now, both cats can be found across Africa, the Arabian Peninsula, and southern Asia. They're both spotted, both fierce. But there are some important characteristics that set them apart. Cheetahs have solid black oval spots. They also have a line running from the corners of their eyes down the sides of their nose towards their mouths. From the right perspective, they look a little like they're crying black tears. Cheetahs generally hunt during the day, so their black tear lines help them absorb light to prevent a blinding effect from the bright sunlight. When the cheetah hunts, it bounds ahead in a burst of speed, running up to 75 miles per hour over short distances. But here's a humbling fact about this speedy predator. The cheetah cannot roar, but the leopard can. Leopards have a more complex pattern on their coats, clusters of black and brown spots that look a little bit like roses. Some scientists say this pattern simulates the plants and shadows, camouflaging the leopard as it stalks its prey in tall grass or lurks in the underbrush. They have white eye lining at the bottom of their eyes, and the white color improves the leopard's vision at night by amplifying the light reflected off of nearby objects. They aren't speedy like their cheetah cousins. Instead, this cat relies on the element of surprise when it attacks. The leopard is so strong that it often hauls its kill into the branches of a tree to keep it safe from scavengers like hyenas. These nocturnal predators stalk antelope, deer, and pigs. But in our first report on today's show, we'll hear about leopards in India that are pressed up too close to human settlements. Wild leopard attacks are increasing in some parts of India as urban areas stretch further into the leopard's natural territory. As the attacks spread, delinquent leopards are being removed from the parks and put in cages. DW correspondent Lakshmi Narayan visited an Indian village where a leopard attacked and killed a little boy recently. He has this report.
I was in Mumbai's Adarsh Nagar neighborhood recently. Men were standing in groups, talking in hushed voices. Behind them was a forest that looked dark and dense in the fading light. I walked down a narrow street, removed my sandals, and entered a small house. Some women were sitting in a circle. No one was speaking. The only sound came from a rattling ceiling fan. A woman was sitting in the middle of the group. She looked pale and withdrawn. Her hair cascaded around her face like a veil. When her brother entered the house, she started crying. She'd lost her only son the previous night. 12-year-old Saurabh Yadav had been mauled to death by a leopard. A man from the neighborhood took me to the place where it happened.
Here's the water container that he bought to wash himself. And those are his slippers.
The boy had been crouching in the dark at an outdoor toilet. The leopard attacked him from behind and took him away. Hundreds of villagers fanned into the forest with flashlights and wood torches to look for him. 3 hours later, they found his dead body, and the leopard was sitting right next to it. A man who was there described the scene.
It had killed the boy and shooed his face and neck. 15 or 20 people were hitting the leopard with stones, and it still didn't give up the child. After a long time, it left the spot and we brought the body back.
Leopard attacks are increasing in this part of India. In the Mumbai region alone, the cats have killed at least 8 people since July last year. Most of them were children from poor families who lived close to the forest. There are several places in India, like in Maharashtra state in the west, or along the Himalayan foothills in the north, where leopards roam close to people's homes. Usually they try to kill goats, cows, or other domestic animals, explains veterinarian Ajay Deshmukh.
Yes. His favorite animal is dog.
Dog?
Yes.
But is a dog a good source of meat?
Yes, it's a stray dog, but they easily get. That's why maybe. And numbers of dog population also increase day by day. So it's maybe easily food for them.
But sometimes the cats also attack people. It's unclear why these attacks happen, but some experts think it's partly because the leopards may mistake a crouching child for a small animal, or at least a weak and easy prey.
The thing is, we don't know. We don't know how these animals use these spaces. They're secretive.
Sunetro Ghoshal is an anthropologist, and he's been studying leopard-human conflicts for the last 8 years. He tells me there's a lot of fear in the community after each attack, and the government comes under pressure to take action.
When there is a demand for such action, and usually the only action that the department knows has historically been to put trap cages.
This used to be standard operating procedure. Wildlife rangers would trap a leopard and release it in some other forest or national park. But leopards are fiercely territorial, and the new arrivals often clashed with the animals already living in the area. India's government even stopped this practice after data showed that moving animals randomly just transferred the conflict to another place.
So at least that upheaval that used to be created of, you know, just taking animals randomly and dumping them elsewhere stopped.
These days, leopards are tagged and released within their home territory, some distance away from where humans and livestock live. If the cat continues to pose a problem, it's captured and then caged in animal sanctuaries. One such place is the Manikdo Leopard Rescue Center, which is about 150 kilometers from Mumbai. Veterinarian Ajay Deshmukh tends to 2 adult females in one of the enclosures. It's a 200 square foot space with lots of shrubs and an elevated platform for the cats to sit on.
She's a Jaya and she's a Jia. Jivu, Kaida. Oh, ho, ho. Igre.
The animals are magnificent. As Jia paces up and down her cage, her muscles ripple and her golden skin glistens in the afternoon sun.
You can put your finger in there, like. Because she keeps running around and he keeps running a lot.
Ha, yes. She is very playful nature. But she is very angry and shy nature. Ah, okay.
There are more than 25 leopards held here and they'll never roam freely again. It's a sad ending for such a beautiful animal and for the people living on the front lines of this conflict. As the temple bells ring in Adarsh Nagar, people gather for evening prayers and to mourn for the dead boy. An adult leopard was trapped here just a few days after the attack. There are no easy solutions to this problem. As India's cities expand, humans will continue to encroach on leopard territory. We just have to learn to coexist, says anthropologist Ghoshal.
We hope the leopard behaves himself. I mean, that's not in our hands. It's not an animal that anyone can control, but we definitely need to understand them better.
For DW, I'm Lakshmi Narayan.
Our next story takes us away from the leopard cages of India and transports us to the site of the worst offshore oil spill in U.S. history. On April 20th, 2010, there was an explosion and a fire at an oil rig belonging to BP in the Gulf of Mexico. 11 rig workers were killed and 4 million barrels of oil leaked into the water. The spill shut down the fishing grounds. These were some of the richest in the U.S. And now, 3 years later, some of the areas have recovered, but others have not. And instead of waiting for the fish stocks to rebound, some fishing communities are looking for ways to make themselves less dependent on the waters that they can't control. Zoe Sullivan has this report from the backyards of Louisiana.
Sang Ho sprays the plants growing in his greenhouse.
I live in America 33 years ago, but I don't have time to come to school. Keep work.
He lives in a suburban part of New Orleans, not far from the wetlands and the open water. He has 5 adult children who he's worked hard to help get ahead. Two of his children are pharmacists. One manicures nails, and the youngest two are studying at university.
Two boys live in Dallas, Houston. That's it. And two little boys live with me.
Tsang has fished the waters off the Louisiana coast for decades. But things changed when an oil rig belonging to BP exploded on April 20th, 2010, spilling millions of gallons of crude oil into the Gulf of Mexico. It was the worst offshore oil spill in U.S. history, and it shut down the nation's richest fishing grounds for months. Fishing communities all along the Gulf of Mexico reported a drop in yields, and later, fish and shrimp with lesions. But Tsang Ho and many of the other people who fish these waters had to find another way to support themselves. Ho started right here, in his own backyard. He's built a small aquaponics system, which provides him with fish and vegetables. We enter his backyard, where he set up tanks that are protected by a small shed. A translucent blue tarp, stretched overhead, forms the roof of his greenhouse. Aside from the tarps, which mellow the intense Louisiana sun, the greenhouse is open on one side. Plastic sheets close the others. Tiny seedlings of basil, lemongrass, and other herbs and greens poke out of small, square plastic pots. They bend gently in the breeze. The fish tank water carries nutrients from the fish's feces, and this fertilizes the plants. The plants digest the nutrients, reducing the toxicity of the water, which is returned to the tanks, and the cycle continues. Almost every aspect of the growing process can be controlled, ensuring that the farmers, like Tsang, enjoy greater financial stability. There are many other Vietnamese fishermen who have set up aquaponics systems like Tsang Ho's. Some have joined an aquaponics farming cooperative run by the MQVN Community Development Corporation. The group was created to help Vietnamese Americans in New Orleans rebuild their lives after Hurricane Katrina, and it's continued its work as the community grapples with the aftermath of the BP oil spill. Kai Nguyen helps run MQVN's Aquaponics Farmers Co-op. He gives the farmers technical advice so that they can run their aquaponics systems and also helps them sell the produce they grow. The co-op is intended to help Louisiana's Vietnamese communities find economic alternatives to fishing.
It all came about from, even before the oil spill, just concerns about overfishing. The fishing industry is very important to Vietnamese people. When they first came to the New Orleans area, they first came to the Gulf after the Vietnam War, this is something that was familiar to them right away, even if the language wasn't, because a lot of these people came from fishing villages in Vietnam.
Oil company BP offered a settlement agreement to compensate people affected by the spill, but not everyone here believes it accounts for all the damage done to their environment. And no one knows what things will be like in a few years. Thanks, buddy. Daniel Nguyen, no relation to Kai, also works with MQVN's Farmer Co-op. He's delivering greens to a New Orleans restaurant.
Yeah, so this is our first stop of the day, or at least for myself, and it's Moropa. In the bywater.
Moropa is one of the Veggie Co-op's regular customers.
Yeah, lemon balm. And Danny, how many pounds of shiso did y'all want today? You have a total of 3 pounds of mescaline today. Did y'all want to take it all?
Roughly 15 local restaurants buy regularly from the aquaponics farmers as a part of a movement in the city to eat locally grown food. Local sourcing means that transporting the food consumes less gas, and less packaging is also required. It also means that the food reflects the seasonal varieties available, bringing the relevant nutrients for summer and winter. Chef Michael Doyle owns Moropa.
Right now, I'm getting lemon balm in from them today. That goes in one of our cocktails. It's a lemon balm sour that goes in a rum cocktail with rhubarb. We've got the greens are coming in. We use the salad greens with pickled kelp and smoked almonds and a scuppernong vinaigrette.
Doyle and other restaurateurs here are helping build vital relationships with local fishing communities and farmers.
I help you, you help me. That's the bottom line. You know, they would probably get less selling in crazy volume, and I would pay more buying at a store for this kind of boutique quality. And so we've gotten to sort of a mutually beneficial point, and, you know, I like them.
There are other aquaponics programs taking root in New Orleans, including near the city's main business district. The Recirculating Farms Coalition and the New Orleans Food and Farm Coalition are partnering up to launch a project that will include aquaponics. Their goal is to raise food and also share growing techniques with urban residents, particularly those with lower incomes. So in the aftermath of one of the worst environmental catastrophes in U.S. history, Louisiana is creating a dynamic, socially responsible food movement based on sustainable urban farming.
Thank you to Zoe Sullivan for that report from Louisiana.
As sly as a fox, as strong as an ox, as fast as a hare, as brave as a bear, as free as a bird, as neat as a word, as quiet as a mouse, as big as a house. As mean as a wolf, as sharp as a tooth, as deep as a bite, as dark as the night, as sweet as a song, as right as a wrong, as long as a road, as ugly as a toad, as pretty as a picture hanging from a fixture, strong like a family, strong as I wanna be, bright as day, as light as a plane, as hard as nails, as grand as a whale.
That was Lenka with her hit, Everything at Once, a sweet tune suited to spring. April 6th marks the 21st anniversary of the start of the Bosnian War and the Siege of Sarajevo. It was the longest siege of a capital city in modern history, and Sarajevo became the site of some of the worst atrocities in Europe since the Second World War. Thousands of people were killed, and millions were displaced from their homes. During the fighting, the city of Sarajevo was almost completely destroyed. Even today, the buildings are pockmarked and the sidewalks are scarred. As for the city's green spaces, well, the parks are little more than garbage dumps. But we're about to meet a group of young people who want to reclaim Sarajevo's parks and make peace with the past. Pavel Schrey has this report.
Downtown Sarajevo. For hundreds of years, this city, built by the Ottomans, was known as the Jerusalem of the Balkans, famous for its tolerance and multiculturalism. The Muslim call to prayer was heard throughout the city. Bells rang from Catholic and Orthodox churches, and ancient synagogues stood in the small stone alleyways of the old city. But in early April 1992, the city was attacked by Serb forces. The siege of Sarajevo lasted 4 years. It was a terror campaign of sniping and shelling that left some 12,000 civilians dead. Today, 20 years on, the scars of the war can still be seen everywhere. On the streets, blast marks in the pavement caused by mortar shell explosions have been filled with red resin. Known now as the Sarajevo Roses, these marks are considered a memorial to the people who died. If you look up at the buildings, almost every facade here is pockmarked with bullet holes. Walking through the parks of the city, you will see thousands of tall marble columns. These are actually tombstones. During the war, many of the city's parks became makeshift Muslim cemeteries. Many of Sarajevo's most beautiful parks were built by the Austro-Hungarians following the First World War. They were designed to complement the grand buildings of the city, both Islamic and Christian. But the long siege changed all that. Today, the city's parks are bleak, run down, and often filled with trash.
Sarajevo is a lot of litter, a lot of pollution. People throw trash. The average park has broken benches, broken play equipment, graffiti, and lots of trash. It's not cared for properly by the local government, and the average person, the average mother who goes there with her children, will also leave diapers and leave trash in the park.
That's Luka Kazits, a young American landscape architect. He has a great love of public spaces and wants to see Sarajevo's parks rejuvenated. So he co-founded an action group to do just that.
MOBA is a non-profit association for the promotion of social responsibility. And we are a youth-led social, you could say, venture. We realize non-profit activities in local community, and we promote volunteerism, corporate social responsibility, all as ways to provide activities for youth to rebuild local parks and to also promote youth enterprise and youth employment.
Luka and his friends arrive at one park near the city centre with big brooms, rakes and rubber gloves on. Snow fell last night and the temperature is well below zero. They collect the rubbish, the broken bottles and the bags of trash people have left here. Environmental awareness is still in its infancy in Bosnia. Luka thinks that by revitalising green, public spaces, they can change the relationship people have with parks, and in doing so, build environmental awareness in the city.
We feel that a beautiful park could change the mentality of people to not throw trash, and maybe if they see one piece of trash, they'll pick it up as their social responsibility.
Luka's not sure why people fail to care for parks in Sarajevo. Maybe it's the crippling recession and the poverty. Or maybe this is a product of the long and brutal siege, a disconnect caused by so much violence and death. It's not that they don't know how to tend to the places they care about.
And it's also very weird because in Bosnia, people really care for their home. Inside the home is spotless, but they don't care about anything outside their home. So we want to say that the park is yours. You know, you need to take care of the park like you take care of your own home, like your backyard. And we really see that community members are at first shocked by what we're doing, but then interested in helping themselves.
Ervina Muftic is one of the MOBA volunteers. The 23-year-old is an architecture student. She painted a vibrant mural for the city's children. It's a cartoon of colourful monsters along the banks of the river in Dobrinja, a suburb of Sarajevo.
I wanted to draw something on the river, something colourful, something with a lot of light, something very happy.
The river is one of the only green areas in Dobrinja. During the war, this suburb became a battlefield. People dumped burnt-out cars and garbage directly into the waters here. Today, the water isn't as dirty, but there is still a lot of work to do. So, as MOBA volunteers clean the riverbank, Ervina used her skills to brighten up the park. And she had a little help.
The children of the neighborhood, they were all those days always near me. They were watching what I was doing, and they were very interested. In the end, I had maybe 20 little helpers. They were really happy. It's very important to include the neighborhood, to include especially the children, because now they have some self-identification with the river and the mural.
Ervina's work is giving the children of this neighborhood a sense of ownership in the world outside their homes. But it is also helping to build a sense of community, something which is desperately needed in post-war Sarajevo. And like Ervina, Luka believes engaging children in environmental cleanup programs will improve their connection to their community and the environment around them.
Regularly we have 20, 30 children helping us with cleaning actions. Like then they start telling us about their friends who throw trash and how it's such a shame and how cool it is for them to work in their local park. And we believe that they will talk with their parents and get their parents involved. So we believe that we will be able to develop a system of maintenance, of advocacy, that will get more and more people interested and at least aware that they need to care for their park.
It's been 20 years since the siege of Sarajevo devastated this city. And while a peace deal here is holding, the city remains divided and ethnic tensions are still a huge problem. But Luka and the MOBA volunteers are committed to reviving Sarajevo's green spaces and putting the legacy of war behind them.
Thank you to Pavel Shry for that report. We've only got a little time left in today's edition of Living Planet, and so we're going to visit Cambodia's first ever marine reserve. It's called Songsa, which means the sweethearts. It's made up of two tiny islands in the Gulf of Thailand that are connected with a footbridge. And if you peer over the side into the water, you might catch a glimpse of the region's marine beauties. triangular batfish, speckled hawksbill turtles. You might even see what looks like little yellow Christmas trees swaying in the current. Those are the Christmas tree worms. They've got some less attractive neighbors, the moray eels, which look like underwater sock puppets, scorpion fish, sea snakes. You might even see a whale shark. The zone was designated a no-take area, which means a total ban on fishing. This regulation is intended to protect marine life that was under threat from unregulated overfishing. But it's also a private resort offering luxury spa vacations for ecotourists, and Songsa is intended to promote sustainability while making money to maintain itself. Officials are very pleased with their progress. Here's a clip from Saran Prak, an officer at the Songsa Marine Reserve.
In terms of conservation, when we set up the original 200-meter marine reserve around Songsa, this community saw a big increase in the quantity of fishing products that it could harvest from the sea. So now that the marine reserve is being hugely extended, we hope to see a further increase in the size of the catch so that the incomes of the local people can be increased even more.
So the marine reserve will be expanded by 200 hectares, making it about 40 times bigger than it is right now. Wayne McCallum is the director of the Footprints organization. It's been established to support environmental protection efforts in the area. Here's what he had to say.
The idea with the extension is to sort of build on what we've already achieved here, and also to link into some of the national initiatives to create a greater marine protected area, which is being led by the Cambodian government. So we see ourselves as sort of providing an example of the way you can proceed with the marine conservation. And in particular, we like the idea of linking our marine work with our community engagement work, because we see those things as being integral. And we sort of have what we call a ridge-to-reef approach, because in the end, what happens on the ridgeline will affect the health and well-being of your coral reefs.
Songsa is an interesting experiment combining tourism, sustainable business development, and environmental protection. Travel into the area brings much-needed cash for conservation, but it often means flying, so officers at the park are facing their next challenge, how to tackle emissions output from tourist travel. We'll be keeping an eye on developments at Songsa Marine Reserve. And that's it for this edition of Living Planet. Thank you for tuning in. I hope you'll join us again next week. We're going to visit some rather rude, flatulent cows in France as farmers look for ways to reduce methane produced by their herds. Hold your breath for that one. For now, I'm Saroja Coelho. From everyone here in studio, thanks for listening. Scorching, killing me softly, Lauren or Kevorkian. Can't tell if she's cuckoo or corky when asked her name and she said, call me.